Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
Thank you, everybody, for listening in. This is Andrew Fetter with When Pigs Fly. I know I've gotten into a lot of politics, and I felt in the recent past, especially those going Occupy, and do it, but do it with love and no violence, please. But I did a turnaround here because I have a special guest. I've been meaning to get him on. I finally did. And it deals in a relation, which, well, you know, my privy of thought of dealing with between the sciences and esoterics and spirituality. And I think it's important that we look in everything in each way in different dimensions and different ways of looking at things. And that's part of our gaining our wisdom and gaining our understanding of things. And we are at a crossroads where I personally think that we're starting to hit where more and more people are being misinformed about the sciences as well as into spiritual context within spirituality. And because of that, I was really intrigued with this book that my guest that I'm going to have, Dr. Bernardo Castro, wrote called Dreamed Up Reality, which I know there's been a lot of astrophysicists and physicists and scientists getting into that field of trying to figure out the aspects of it. And in fact, it goes back in the day since even Einstein or further beyond that. I want to, first of all, thank him for finally coming onto my show. And I know there's going to be many questions, and I don't know where this interview is going to go because it's basically going from the hip, because I've read his book and it's very fascinating. You all should read it. It gets into the real attempts to get into, let's say, for consciousness. Again, Dr. Bernardo Castro, I welcome you on my show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
Looking in your book, it was really fascinating because it is a preview of mine that, because I do go out of body and deal with dreams. In fact, it was sort of ironic because I was teaching a class yesterday and people were asking me about that. Because I do teach Kabbalah, but I do teach and get into some aspects of what they call Merkava, which is actually going out of body. So I'm always curious of how science applies their methodology, which you apply in here. And that was always the problem I find with scientists. They try to apply a methodology on spirituality, which is sort of like the opposite of the reality of nature. And this is where I find the problem with sciences. Even today, they're running into a wall where you point out, which is really good. You made this comment that was unreal. We know how to produce a technology with our science, but we don't know shit about nature.
Right. Yes.
And my thing is because they're looking at, and I don't understand why they don't see it, but every astrophysicist, every physicist I've read, going all the way back from the times of relativity, that got away from Newtonian physics and that way of thinking, when the universe is absolutely at an infinite capacity, why do they keep on trying to apply finite ways of measurement and finite ways of determination?
Mm-hmm.
It's like what they're doing is, it's basically, I talked to you about your little bit in your book in my class, because people were asking, I said, it's like taking water. If water is a consciousness and water is everything, then we're taking a cup and we're freezing that water, sticking it in the cup or whatever, and then we're going, oh, that's what the water really is. And then we stick it and we heat it up the water and go, no, that's what the water is. So we're constantly trying to apply things that are in a finite capacity into a cup.
Right. Well, a scientist would say that science goes forward, science progresses over time, so we are refining our understanding in science, and we never really know the whole story. And that is true. It's an honest way to defend against what you just said. But there is one very fundamental way, I think, in which science limits itself, and it's necessary that it does so if it is to remain effective in the production of technology and improving our lives, and that is that we assume in science that what we perceive is the complete and undistorted story of reality. And in a way that's a bit contradictory, because science itself says that our perceptions are not a direct contact with reality. They are just the image of reality that is engendered in our brains. And there is a correlation between that and what is really out there. But there is no guarantee that that correlation is complete or even accurate. Actually, evolutionarily, we would have evolved to create a mirror of reality that would be as distorted and as incomplete as necessary for survival, if that would benefit survival in any way. And yet, the entire edifice of science is built on the assumption that what we perceive is really what is out there without distortion, and largely complete except for what we can extend with our instruments, even though our instruments themselves, by construction, are limited to the subset of reality that we can perceive biologically.
Well, I like it because you use the word perception, and perception is based upon our experiences, and they're also prejudiced by our previous experiences as well. And scientist is doing observation, and I know, you know, from the way the collapse of the wave function and also the predetermination of the outcome of an experiment, there's an influence of the outcome. So then there becomes a problem where and the limitation of a perception, because in effect we see things at normal capacity, they're at 16 clicks per second, am I right, or something like that, and yet there's billions upon billions of clicks per second that our eyes see, but our brains or consciousness or somehow can't relate to unless, we change that. And then And it has to do, one thing you pointed out was, and I know because a lot of esoterics talk about this, is like you have a physical body, then there's the mind, and then there's the observer behind the mind. Mm-hmm. So how would scientists, and this is what you're sort of touching upon, I noticed in your book.
Right. Well, in a way you raised two very interesting points. One is, what do we perceive of reality? Do we perceive it all, or do we perceive only a limited subset? And there are two aspects to this. We do perceive only a subset, and that is recognized by science. Our eyes cannot perceive more than a certain frequency range. For instance, beyond ultraviolet, we can't see. The same goes for our ears, and so on. That is the known part of nature, known to science, that we cannot perceive directly. And that's why we have our instruments, our telescopes, all kinds of instruments that we use to extend our perceptions. I think the key and the most significant part is what we do not know is out there, because it so far exceeds even the framework of our perceptions. It's not just an extension. It far exceeds the framework. To make a mathematical metaphor, you could think of hyperdimensions that not only are beyond the range of what we can perceive, but are beyond the entire thought framework of what our perceptions are all about. And that is a total unknown. And then you raised something else in your question, which is what is the relation between what we observe, the mind that observes, and the observer behind that mind? Science would not recognize this third element. Science would say there is a world out there. It is independent of mind. It's made of matter. So is our brains. And consciousness, our ability to be aware and perceive, is somehow a kind of phosphorescence, a secondary phenomenon. The technical term is an epiphenomenon of the matter of the brain. And there is no observer behind that. That's the whole story. Now, of course, that is an enormous assumption, because nobody to this day has been able to explain how a subjective perception arises out of something as unconscious as matter, as a collection of neurons.
Yeah, but here's an example where a scientist doesn't know how, sort of screwed up, is how you go to explain to somebody who's been in a place, who's never been ever in his entire life, had no certain area, like this happened to me, but there's other people I know have been in areas, never in their lifetime have been in this place, and absolutely know everything about where the streets are and everything else without ever being there.
Science today would Can I comment on that, or do you want to continue on the question?
Okay, and esoteric, I'd say, was because that was a previous life that you were there. I'm talking from the spiritual side.
Mm-hmm.
So esoteric would say, oh, that was from, because you were probably in your previous life, you were there, and you always take your experiences with you from lifetime to lifetime, so they're attached to you in this form of energy, because we're basically energy. That would be the comment by esoteric, okay?
Right.
And as scientists would say, what would you say?
If you look at science, is a term for so many things going on out there, and so many disagreements as well in the framework of science. And if you add philosophy to this, then you get an even bigger soup of opinions, myths, and stories. If you look at reductionist science, the more skeptical, even maybe a little bit fundamentalist part of science, there would be no explanation for that other than to say that it is chance, coincidence, or can be explained by something else trivial. In the context of philosophy and some areas of science, there is a very rational way, a very logical, coherent way to place this phenomena, I believe. And that is not new. It comes from the late 19th century, starting with people like Henri Bergson and later on Charlie Broad and others. And the idea there is, if consciousness is not generated by the matter of the brain, and that seems not to be the case indeed, it seems that consciousness cannot be seen as a epiphenomenon of matter, then it is a fundamental property of nature, just like mass, spin, electrical charge, or whatever. It is a fundamental property of nature, maybe even more fundamental than the others I just named. And then the role of the nervous system is not to generate subjective perception, but to filter down and constrain subjective perception to the space-time location of the physical body, because that would be a survival advantage. Now, this is an old idea again, but it would also be entirely consistent with the correlation between brain states and subjective perceptions that we observe today. Like if you get drunk, you change the brain state by injecting a chemical in it, and your perception of the world changes. Therefore, the brain must generate consciousness. That's one alternative. The other alternative is the brain filters down consciousness. It frames conscious perception. So if you mess up with the filter, your conscious perception will change. Now, the difference is, the latter hypothesis, that the entire nervous system, your sense organs, your brain, is filtering down a unbound, unlimited potential for conscious perception. If that is the case, then it opens up the possibility that if you somehow temporarily or partially bypass those filtering mechanisms of the brain, then you can receive an inflow of conscious perceptions that far exceed what would be the limitations of your sense organs. In other words, conscious perceptions that far exceed the space-time boundaries of your physical perceptions. And that would be a very natural thing to expect. You distort those filters, you bypass or take those filters down, and there is an inflow of perceptions from across space, from across time. And that, in my view, that would be a way to frame this phenomena that you have observed and myself. I have observed those phenomena myself too.
Well, the thing that's an application where the science has sort of screwed up on this is why I fear there's a contradictory situation with science, and I'll explain. I think what Einstein was right when he got into it, he said everything is energy. So if you look at, let's say, consciousness as a form of energy, and you look at the mind as another form of energy, and everything sort of interrelates, all energy interrelates to another energy. So then you can look, if you look at it that way, then if you look at, and I know I'm jumping here, but the problem with science is from a physical side to, because they keep on jumping from a Newtonian way to back to a relative way, is like, for example, autistic children, which is a perfect example of what you're talking about, where people don't understand. Like, I know people who have autistic children, and the scientists do not know F what to do with them. And basically because they don't realize perhaps that they perceive another spatial reality than what we see in a spatial reality. So when they try to communicate that reality that they see, we think, what the hell is going on? Yet they're probably, they find them absolutely brilliant on certain things. So they, so is their reality incorrect or not correct? And the problem is, the only reason why they're not correct is because it's not, I quote, put this in quotes, conformed to what a general person would culturally identify as being what's the environment or the spatial relationship or this, the things that we all would spatially see. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, so, yes.
So what happens with our perception is if we're all in a room and I see like two people see a ghost walk through and eight of the people say, what the hell? The eight people think those two people are a little crazy because they see a ghost.
Yes,
and
yes.
That's where the problem lies.
If you look at how science goes about it, I'm entirely with you on this. If you look at how science goes about it, science is the art of producing statistical truths. In other words, you produce several observations independently by several different people. You eliminate the extremes of those observations. You assume that something went wrong. The ones that more or less are around the average, you add them up and you divide by the total number of observations and you get a mean, an average. And that becomes your idea of truth, even if not one single observation corresponded to that exactly. So you, that's what Carl Jung used to talk about already back in the 40s and 50s, that we have a statistical view of reality with our science that is ultimately, if you look strictly at it, ultimately unreal because it does not correspond to subjective observation necessarily. And subjective observation, our own personal experiences, are the only carrier of reality that we can ever know. So, yes, I could imagine that different people, we have an average view of reality that, and I talk about this in the book, that we may have evolved through language, through culture, through communication to agree on, to synchronize our minds on. So we all sort of have the same dream, if you will, like in that movie, I forgot the name of that movie, where people share a dream. We may have evolved these constraints through communication, through language, to see the same thing. In that statistical distribution, some people fall out of that. Maybe their filtering mechanisms are operating differently because of genetic defects or because of a completely different education or a talent that they are born with. And they see something else. And the question is, who is the judge to say that what they are experiencing is not real and what we are experiencing is real just because we are the majority, right? I think the same case could be made for schizophrenics, maybe even more interesting than autistic children.
Right, right. That's another thing, because I know people that I've actually worked with. In fact, it's funny you said that, because there was a girl who I worked helping her out dealing with her sister, who everybody thought was schizophrenic clinically, and which is another issue. And then when they turned her out, I actually told her, just from my feeling, whatever my abilities, I said, no, I don't think she has anything chemical. It's more a process of her identification of things. She's actually more out there. She sees more things, so people are confusing, and so she's sort of freaking out what she sees and tries to... Because a lot of people who... Let me put it this way. There are a lot of people who actually have abilities. They see and hear a lot of things out there that's more information. They can actually feel what people are thinking. It's having like a bunch of radios going off, okay? Mm-hmm. So some of these people like freak out, and then personal class, oh, there must be schizophrenic because they're hearing a whole bunch of things. Yet they can hear and read what you're thinking. They can read the guy next door what they're thinking. And they're hearing all this information, and they know what the hell's going on. They're hearing it all at once. So The natural doctor will go, which is getting back to Dr. Lipton had said, that our medical sciences and the reality of sciences is in a direct conflict of each other, which I was trying to explain to you in the beginning, is like they look at people like a Newtonian part, like we're a machine or a mechanical part. When in reality, if they identify things as energy, science would be on the nose. If they look at as a human brain, and then as energy, and the consciousness is energy, and then they look in that way of approximation of everything within like a quantum way of looking things, and looking at the universe and its infinite capacity, and apply, instead of concrete measurements, approximations in mathematics, because everybody likes to use math. And then I think that we'd be more on course. And this is where I think that the problem with science is they're like causing a problem because they're double talking in their own mouths. They're wanting to go further down the road, but then they're afraid of what they might find. It's like finding the real God. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's so much to say about this. If you look at the leading edge of science, what we've discovered over the last, say, 110 years, 111 years, since the turn of the 20th century, it is mind-boggling. If you look at the true worldview that is derived from science today, you know, time and space are not absolute, they are relative, reality is not really deterministic, there is talk of multiple parallel universes, there's talk of our entire reality being a kind of simulation, and there are good arguments, very good coherent rational arguments for that. Now, all of these advances, they don't seem to have percolated through the majority of the practitioners of science. The mindset of the average scientist, as you said, as you correctly observed, I think, is still fairly Newtonian, reductionist, and deterministic. So I think there is a lot of room to go just by continuing to follow the scientific methodology, not only for the development of technology, but for enlarging our understanding of nature, our ontology and epistemology, if you will. All this said, I do think there is one aspect in the entire methodology of science that is fundamentally limiting, and that is that science is a third-person investigation methodology. In other words, it dismisses individual personal experience as weak data, and it glorifies the statistical average of multiple experiences in an impersonal way, especially instrumentation, which is the ultimate third-person experience, if you will. And that leaves out the idiosyncrasies, the ineffable aspects of our perceptions, which is the only carrier of reality that we as individuals can ever know. There is so much science can say nothing about, even language. Even language cannot be used to describe so much of what goes on in our minds if we drift on an afternoon nap, or if we have a spontaneous mystical experience, if you will, or where our minds wander through deep meditation or through brain entrainment. You don't even have language to express that. And I think those areas are fundamentally outside the scope of the scientific methodology. And that is not a bad thing for science. I think science is tremendously effective in what it can do, but we should not elevate it in our society to the position of judge and jury of ontology and the nature of reality. That is not what that method is good for. It is excellent for cutting out loose thinking and producing technology, but not as the judge of ontology, in my view.
Well, I think what you're saying is because the science has always tried to be what they call disinterested, where they have no interest, where that so can be as objective as possible. By being objective as possible is taking out the applied perceptions and any application. But this is right. But this is here where, like you said, I was going to want to get into before. I'll give you an example. And I remember Lipton had spoken about this on another. I heard him on a speaking engagement a long time ago, and he said why this is for medical science. Why is it that we use? Here's how I'll show you how it's so weird in our medical fields. They use energy to determine the illness, but then you use Newtonian application they use the diagnosis of looking at things as energy, like we use X-rays. Ultra scans, MRIs, we use energy, we figure the energy fields, that's how it's determined, right? And then when they use the application, they go back to figuring out we're like an auto parts store, you know, they use drugs and this and that, and they don't realize, except for they do, X-rays and stuff like that for gamma radiation for cancer when they don't even know what the hell they're doing. And they use applications of energy. They don't use any application of energy. They use just like pills and drugs and et cetera, like fixing of parts. So it's sort of opposite. Here they're trying to determine something utilizing energy by using an energy way of thinking. And then they go back to looking like changing parts in a car. When we're not parts of a car, we're basically, we have all this energy moving around our bodies, which they're finding out. It's like DNA. They're now realizing DNA is not the determining factor of what our bodies are. It's actually more of a communication flow. There's a whole lot of information placed on the DNA, and subject to our environment, that's what that little blueprint decides to utilize. So so they know that something outside is happening, and they also know that how come DNA they've seen expand and contract based upon the feelings of the person. So that's another quasi. See, there's all these things that science, because of the emotional aspect and all that stuff, they don't know how to deal with it, like thoughts. They know now thoughts are actually energy. They've even took fills or shots of thoughts. They've done things where, I was looking up because I was trying to bring it up for the show, and it was a famous thing done. It was a guy, they took a DNA test. They took a tissue of somebody. They stuck it on a lie detector on both the tissue and on the person. And the tissue, I remember, was done in New York, and the tissue was done someplace else. And they actually watched the person in the lie detector, and the lie detector would move on the tissue the same readings as the person himself, wherever he was. Which was, how would that, how does that piece of tissue energy connect with this person? It wouldn't make any sense to, in the sciences, quote unquote, of figuring that out. Except for if they would apply, going back to what Einstein's relativity of looking at things, all things are energy, and then looking at things in a quantum. Like, they do have the tools. This is what I'm saying to you. It's so ironic. They have the tools in front of them. They have the things that have been said for upteen hundreds of years. Yet they have this fear thing of going back to what all the great scientists have told them in the past. This is what I find out, and it's more ego-based and fear-oriented as opposed to reality. This is what I feel with scientists. They're more they have fear of really knowing, because it's taking the mirror and placing in front of their face of their scientists.
Well, maybe you're right. It is not my personal experience, at least at a conscious level, that scientists have fear to the point that would prevent them from investigating certain potentially promising avenues of research. I think in a way what we are all struggling with, scientists, lay people, esoteric people, we are all struggling with concepts and models. And we all have different words for things that we fundamentally don't understand. I mean, when we are 5-year-old kids, all we see are images in front of us. Even our own self is not well defined. Our body is one image amongst many. It's just a special image, because when you move that special image, the other images seem to move along. So, but fundamentally, we see images, and then we start trying to conceptualize and trying to create models for it. And then in science, you get these concepts, which are tremendously difficult to pin down, and you use the words, but behind those words are very difficult concepts, like energy. It is a fundamentally difficult thing to define and explain and understand. What exactly is energy? And in the esoteric world, we talk about soul, the etheric body. Okay. These are also concepts and models. And to what extent are we saying similar things as far as our personal experiences, and just using different words and different cultural backgrounds and different assumptions behind the meaning of the words we are using, but fundamentally we are trying to capture the same experiences? I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know how far science could go in trying to apply that concept of energy as opposed to a more material concept, given that these are all concepts. In science and physics today, even the force fields are mediated by particles, force-carrying particles. Our model of reality today is so materialistic that even force fields are mediated by particles. That's where we are in science today.
So it's how far... It's like, somebody on my show, and they were talking about dark energy and dark matter, and they are explaining what dark matter is, where they take two cups and they smash them together, and then physically the cups blow apart. And then he said that, well, then dark matter is actually, there's still a dark matter, and actually the same matter is still continuing as if the cups were in whole. And And they are saying that that's one, and then there was a thing called the dark energy, which is the opposite, the counter of gravity. And they are saying that, this is astrophysicists saying, actually I had two say the same thing, that up till now they assume there's 95% of the universe is made up of dark matter and dark energy, but they don't know what the hell. They know it's there, but they don't know anything about it. So that basically, they only know 5% of the universe, and that's not including antimatter.
it may be even only 4%. When we use the word dark energy, it sounds like we know more about it than what we actually know. Dark energy as a word is just a placeholder. We observe the speed with which things in the universe seem to be getting more distant from one another, and we realize that gravity alone wouldn't be sufficient to explain the observations, that we would need another force that seems to be pushing the universe out and making things go further apart with increasing acceleration. And then we use a word for that, dark energy, but we have absolutely no clue what it is. It is just a placeholder. It just means that we have no idea of what's going on. That's all it means, and it comes across as if we knew more than that, but well, we don't.
Well, you know, it's interesting because of what you say, because there's a concept. This is actually found in both Taoism and Kabbalah, it's looked at. Both of them look at things, and this is telling you just how it looks. And you look at wisdom. Wisdom you cannot put into words. There's no, and real wisdom is like going to, if you're looking to a thermometer, you're looking up in the sky, like example, I'm just giving you just a way of a model. It would be like you can't put something, it's like going, you're eating an apple and you're experiencing eating the apple, and the experience you're having the apple before you even put a thought, that's what the wisdom of the apple. Get it?
Right.
Then when you, the minute you try to put it in a framework of a thought, because our thoughts will try to apply words, that's where it becomes an understanding. So this is where the science has the issue, where if they look at, like, what sort of surprises me is all the ideas, like the ideas that come from scientists with the hypothesis and the geniuses and all this from, you know, I go, every one, they have a where did the idea come from? The idea didn't just come out, this chemical thing in their brain that manufactured this great idea of relativity or Newtonian or, you know, whatever, or Edison or Tesla. They all had an idea, and where did the idea come from? So in esoterics, they would say the esoteric came from the wisdom from beyond, which is what found out everything's out there in the universe, and we just didn't, it came into us through our, you would say, like, through that, out beyond the consciousness, into the conscious, into the observer, into our mouths, and when we finally put it into our consciousness is when we have the understanding of it, then that's when we apply it to words and the thoughts, and then we express it out. So this is where, that's what I was trying to say to you. Science actually, to me, this is how I feel. If science could touch, they're never meant to be together, like we said in the beginning of the show, but if they can touch each other, like in that application, I think we'd go leap in strides for what we could do as far as between our sciences. I mean, the abilities to heal and do things would go unparalleled. The things that we'd be able to find within the realities in our universe. Even things that I'm not going to get into UFOs or stuff like that, but even to those aspects, that some things that people see and understand a reverse, like of antimatter and anti-gravity applications and things they perceive, those things that we could actually, or energy, we can actually apply utilizing just the touch between the two. And that's where I think it's the understanding from the sciences, because I know a lot of people in the so-called New Age or whatever you call it, they all go, well, it has to be one together. And I don't think so, because it needs a slight separation, because we have the fact that we have matter and we have things, we have to look at that side, but there should be a touching of each other so that both can move forward. Because this is where I think we're both unstuck, and it would drastically affect humanity personally if those could be touched, because it would change how people see, you know, the whole that thing that people realize that we're all really connected, which in reality we are, but they don't see it because they're using their thinking, they're using their perception as that we're separate. And that's, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think one of the key, maybe unconscious problems of sciences, of the sciences today is hubris. It's the idea that we've almost figured it all out and there is very little room for radical change. That we think we almost figured the game out, and maybe we haven't figured it at all. I think I am with you on this idea that science and a more subjective exploration of nature should touch and cross-fertilize one another, if you will, although they don't need to be one. And the analogy I make for that is that scientists wouldn't dispute what I'm about to say. Science is to reality like a map is to the streets of a city. Science makes models, play things with, for instance, mathematical models or computer simulations, which we use to try to explain things that have happened in the past and predict things that will happen in the future if the circumstances are so and so. Models, toys, if you will. I don't mean toys in a pejorative way, but models, mirror images of reality, like a map is to the streets of a city. Now, nobody would look at a map and say, this is the city. No, there is a correspondence. There is an isomorphism, a correspondence of form between the little drawings on that piece of paper, the ink on that piece of paper, and the real streets of a city. But that piece of paper is not a city. Now, the same applies to the models of science. The models of science are not reality. They are models. They are tools that help us explain and predict within the boundaries of our perception and within the boundaries of the scientific paradigm of the time, a set of subjective beliefs that changes over time and which gives you the motivation to say that a potential explanation is a valid one or is mumbo jumbo, and that changes over time as well. There was a time when gravity was considered a supernatural thing that could not be accepted. Bodies attracting each other at a distance? This is nonsense. It can't be. And yet, it was embodied in the altar of science afterwards. Now it's again out because now space-time gets distorted. It's a different story. But I think the key synergy would be if we had both the maps of science and the direct, personal, immediate experience of the truths of nature. And that is something that science cannot give us with those models, those mathematical equations, those computer simulations. This direct experience of the truths of nature and reality is a responsibility of each one of us alone. It is direct experience. Nobody can tell it to you. Nobody can explain it to you. Either you have that experience or you don't have it. And the synergy is when we can have both the map and the city. How well could we navigate around and if we had both? And that's where they have to touch, I think.
Hello, Bernard. Hello?
I'm here, Andrew. I'm here. We lost you.
Yeah. We had a power outage in the area here. Just hit all of a sudden. Had it happened this early this morning, and then just now, just everything went out, gone. I was trying to call back on my cell, but my cell phone, I was actually charging up. So see if I can get that going. You talk about, hey, see, it's all this preconceived science here.
Technology, huh?
Yeah, technology. That talks about another thing. You know, we're getting so tied in technology. We're supposed to be getting some interesting solar energy from our solar forest. We haven't had a sunspot in who knows how long. And they have even grounded our electrical stuff here. And we may have a real problem if they don't. You know, if we have a solar flare that hits, causing electromagnetic pulse in our thing, it'll mess up all our cell phones for who knows how long. Anyway, so getting back to, I lost where we were.
So you were talking about the synergy between science and esotericism, or whatever technique of subjective exploration we could have.
Well, this is where I was thinking of an application. This is where if this is where the issue is. It's not trying to find out like the observations of. We use the models that you talk about and the experimentations. And I think like the quantum physics has it on hand. If they can take the mathematical approximation and looking things in an infinite capacity, if they apply a experimental model out of that,
mm-hmm.
I personally think that we would be heading toward the right direction. Do you understand what I'm saying? I know it's hard to do that because we're so locked into that preconceived notion that we have to do all these observations to get to what we, you know, and then you do like you're talking about in the getting and making sure that everybody has same. If we have 400 observations and what, and out of 400, I know that's how they do that, and they'll, you know, the continuous science that the same experiment has to be produced the same way no matter what, and it has to produce the same results. So getting away from that and doing what they call approximation of things, that's the, you know, if scientists could figure out a new methodology of experimentation, that's actually what changed things. That was my feeling. And I've been pondering in my head how they would do it. But that's where I think where science needs to allow itself to some even small little bit. And then I think if we do that, we'll actually, you know, how we had a major jump when people looked at relativity. Then we made another jump when we coined quantum. Then made another jump when we got into the semiconductors. We've been making all these jumps really, if you think about historically within humanity, within 200 years, including the times of Edison and all that stuff, actually that's a bleep of technology out of nowhere and understandings and science that we've jumped.
Mm-hmm. I think.
So that's where that's my feeling, you know. I don't know.
I think what we use the term science, what we mean by this is the strict application of the scientific methodology, which embodies a number of formulations, some of which are very general, some of which are very restrictive. For instance, science entails empiricism. Don't just think up an idea, try it out. Test it empirically, make an experiment. That's a very powerful thing, empiricism. It's not science. It's a part of science. It's entailed by science. But it has existed for much longer, many thousands of years before science got its current form. The use of logic and rationality, the search for the simplest explanation or the one that requires the least number of new assumptions. These are also part of the scientific method, but in themselves, they are not science, and they are very generic and very powerful. Science entails a number of other things in addition to this, like you have to build enough statistics, you have to have many independent observations, and you have to have an objective approach to the subject. And that's what I think you're hinting at. These are the restrictive things. Because the moment you require a lot of objectivity, a lot of statistics, a lot of repetition, you're leaving out of the scope of science those idiosyncratic personal experiences that we personally experience as very real, as more real than real, that we have no doubt that is a part, an integral and legitimate part of nature, and yet it's forever outside the scope of the scientific methodology. We can approach those, I believe, through the application of the more generic and beneficial aspects of the scientific method, like empiricism, logic, coherent thinking, without having to incorporate the whole of what is entailed by the scientific method, like all the statistics, all the objectivity, third-party experimentation, independent confirmation, because subjective experience is not amenable to that in an easy way. If we did that, we would go very far, it is my belief. We shouldn't call it science, because the power of science resides in its complete methodology. We should reserve the name, that's my personal opinion, we should reserve the name science for that very strict yet very powerful formulation. But we should apply empiricism, we should apply logic, we should apply rationality to explore subjective experience that does not render itself to any statistical exploration. We call it something else, and we also avoid elevating science to the position of supreme judge of the ontological truth. That is just not justifiable, I think.
Well, the reason I'm saying that, in a way, a lot of it has to do, what you're talking about is actually more cultural, because if you look at what how a lot of the sciences has influenced, okay, actually it was influenced, and I'm talking Western looking, because if you go Eastern, and you go back through history and time to like the Chinese, for example, they had like the sciences and the philosophers and the esoterics were sort of working together. And then you go to the time period of when modern, I'm saying like in Christianity, when it came form in its real form of today with Constantine, where they started doing what they call the mentality of separation, where first what they did is separate man from nature, and then they separated man from God, and everything became separate. So they developed in their own frame of mind in Western culture the separation. Now this separation of mentality continued on within the sciences. So you already started with these, like what you say, the models, the separation of models. Whereas opposed into, if you go into the Eastern side, there weren't those separation values, because they were looking on things from the Taoist way of looking at things were already like blurred together. So they always looked like there was no duality. There was called the yin and yang is not duality. The yin and yang would be complementary to each other. So there's always a symbiotic relationship. Everything is always connected. And I think in the Eastern, it was always everything connected. So they would apply that same system. It's like the acupuncture and meridians. I mean, I remember back they're utilizing, you know, acupuncture and stuff like that for, you know, even in hospitals in China and stuff like that. And then here in the U.S., I remember back in the 70s when I was a kid, I was curious about doing a report on it. And there was maybe one or two places to do that, and the medical wouldn't look at acupuncture as being a real medical form. But now they're going, oh yeah, there actually is energy meridians running around the body, and now they can accept it to some extent or whatever. So it's my explanation is it's more cultural based. Our sciences are cultural based. And if we went to like the Eastern, why is it the sciences, what I'm not saying is why was the Eastern sciences of the Chinese and way back then were able to do what they did? I mean, there's like, the reason I'm saying all this is because I'm seeing even from our ancients had technologies, they incorporate both together. Like how did the Egyptians have, they had batteries, they had luminous bulbs. There was technology way back then for some reason, only kept whatever. Yeah. But the technology, but they merged it with esoterics, with their sciences, which is how they were able to do a lot of things they do. But then it became a cultural thing. That's what I'm saying to you.
That is established. Many scientists ignore this because many scientists ignore philosophy of science, which is the underlying basis of what they do every day. And yet most scientists, I would even dare say that, most scientists ignore philosophy of science. But it is established in philosophy of science that science is a cultural phenomenon, is a phenomenon of a group of people working together under a certain set of common beliefs and values, which Thomas Kuhn back in the 60s called a scientific paradigm. In other words, what Kuhn observed and pretty much documented, and it's largely accepted today, is that you cannot do science without that cultural undercurrent of a set of beliefs, values, and things that you hold dear to yourself, which are basically subjective assumptions. They do not have an empirical basis. They just guide what you consider to be valid hypotheses or not. And that changes over time. And it doesn't seem to be changing in a single direction. It is all over the place. So yeah, I am with you. Science is cultural, and it's based on these cultural assumptions, the strongest of which is the idea that our experience of mind, in other words, our experiences, because they only reside in mind, that mind is separate from objective reality, that mind is a kind of epiphenomenon of objective reality. That is a strong cultural assumption. It does not have an empirical basis because we are locked into our minds. We just project and assume there is something outside of it, which is by definition beyond the power, beyond our power to experience. If you look back far enough in history, and you don't need to go too far, and you don't even need to go to the East, Andrew, if you look at alchemy, 500 years ago, even less, 400 years ago, people like Gerhard Dorn, for instance, in their treatises, Gerhard Dorn was a doctor, and in his treatises, in his philosophy, in his books, he clearly makes no distinction between mind and objective reality. To the alchemists, these two things were one and the same thing. The philosopher's stone, the lapis philosophorum, was at the same time a stone and a state of mind. For them, implicitly or explicitly, this distinction between objective reality out there and my experience of it in here, my mind, did not exist. It's a cultural assumption that has been built starting at the Renaissance and then through the Enlightenment, and today dominates our worldview to the point that most people, even lay people, take it for granted as if it was an empirical fact of reality, and it is not.
So you're saying it was a cultural evolution within the sciences started around the Renaissance time, where they actually disengaged to create that separation between the spirituality of and the mind and things like that to the actual, making it more so-called objective as rather than perceptive. Is that what you're
saying? That's what I'm saying, and it started with René Descartes, who maybe, in order to safeguard the freedom of science in view of the power of the church at that time, started with this separation between the things of spirit, in other words, the things of mind, and the things of objective reality. And this dualism sort of gave the church its sphere of influence and gave science its sphere of influence. And I understand some of the rationale behind it, but it's fundamentally based on an unproven assumption, which is that mind and reality are completely separate things that interact at the level of perception. We don't know that. All we have is perception. All we have is our own minds. It is not, we went to the extreme today that we say that mind is derived from the brain, while in fact, all we know is mind. The brain we learn about in school. For all you know, it's the brain that is in the mind, not the mind that is in the brain. That would be the hypothesis of idealism, which is a serious hypothesis in philosophy. And science has all but confirmed it in 2007 in a paper that was published in Nature magazine, number 446, if I remember correctly, in which they basically, they've all but proven that, mind and objective reality are intertwined. They may be the same thing. And yet nobody talks about it. It's amazing.
So basically there's no more talk of the chicken and the egg, or hatching the egg, of between mind and what you're talking about. Because it's almost like which came first, the idea or the mind?
If you think, there is a philosopher, a French philosopher that I love because he thinks like a 5-year-old kid, and I think that's the way to go. His name is Henri Bergson. He doesn't have a French name. He was a naturalized French citizen. He used to think like a 5-year-old kid. He would say, "What do I see as a 5-year-old kid before people taught me that there is such a thing as matter, that there is such a thing as the brain and the nervous system and perception separate from objective reality? What do I see as a 5-year-old kid? I see images. Matter to me is just images. There is no distinction between matter and my perception of it. The perception is all I have access to. So my entire universe is images. And there is one image that seems privileged, and that's the image of my body, because that's the image I can control directly through the exercise of my will, while the others I can only control indirectly through the action of my body." It's a brilliant way of seeing this, because he basically puts the body inside the mind. not the mind inside the body. That is the intuitive point of view of a five-year-old kid. My body is inside my mind. It is an image, a privileged one. If I move it, my perspective changes. So it is a privileged image, but it resides in the mind. That's our natural experience. It's just that we come to believe in stories and myths and models so strongly later on that we lose contact with our own basic animal intuition about what's going on.
So let me ask, because there's... So let me ask it, because I was going to ask you another thing. There's an experiment they did. It's actually the first one that was sort of funny when you did. Can you go in the process of how, because that was actually, and I don't want to say anything, but it was sort of the only thing that was sort of not clear was how you did your experiment, especially the first one. Can you explain what you exactly did when you did the experiment? And can you tell the audience why you were doing this first experiment? So they understand where you're coming from.
So my background is very rationalistic. I've been a professional scientist for many years. Today I work in technology, high-tech marketing, and so on. So the first thing I did, the first thing that happened to me was I had some spontaneous experiences, and I just remembered where my cognition, my mind wandered during a couple of afternoon naps. Normally we forget it completely, but a couple of times I remembered it entirely, and it was not just a silly dream. It was a coherent frame of mind that was extraordinary, ideas that were extraordinary, assumptions, beliefs, and memories of about what reality is that I just couldn't make sense in my normal state of mind. And I just happened to remember where my mind had wandered. So what I did next was try to validate this, not as something, a weird thing happening to me, some kind of short circuit in my brain, but validate it in a coherent rational framework, which I did through studying philosophy, studying people like C.D. Broad and others, which basically put forward the notion that the nervous system filters consciousness, and that if you could bypass those filters, you could gain access to a level of perception of reality that is non-local. It exceeds the location in space-time of your physical body. And I found that fascinating, so I started trying to see whether I could have those experiences on demand, if I could develop a personal technique that worked for me to get into that state of mind, that non-local state of mind, on demand, by simply trying and succeeding in doing that. And I looked at a whole host of traditional and less traditional techniques, amongst the traditional ones, meditation, visualization, sensory deprivation. I looked at high-tech methodologies like brain entrainment, binaural beats, things like this. And over time, I distilled techniques that worked for me in certain occasions. I don't think there is a surefire recipe that works for everyone. I think we all have a certain physical and psychological makeup. So in the book, I, on purpose, don't really say exactly what I did. I just put the menu. I describe the menu in the book of the alternatives that are out there. I don't even explain how to do them. There are better books for that. But I didn't discuss what exactly I did, because I didn't want to validate one specific approach to the detriment of another, because for somebody else it may be the opposite that will work. I don't know.
Well, okay. What was I don't understand why you said that, because you don't want to get into each of methodologies and stuff like that. You're right. There's a lot of, and everybody has their own way, and it's an old way. There's no such thing as my way is the right way. Everybody has, and it's really reflective of everybody's own perceptions and feelings and comforts or whatever. But let me ask you this: what can you explain the methodology, what you use? Because that was the only thing that was sort of gray, that I didn't get what you were trying to do. Because you talk about lucid dreams, and the next thing I know, you're going right into your experiment. I go, whoa! The reason why I'm selling this, because I've written three books. On my last book, I actually dealt with sort of going out of body. So I literally wrote down per detail in the first part or the first experience. I first gave actually a sort of summation. Then the next one I gave really in detail exactly the events, what happens, to the methodology to do it. So tell me what method you use specifically to some extent of what you did to go into that dreamscape that we would normally call a dreamscape or that dream area or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, I will share with you what may be a prejudice of in my case. I don't know whether it's fair to say what I'm about to say, but I think fundamentally, whatever you try, whatever combination of techniques may work, and for me, different combinations work at different moments in time. What worked in my first experiment didn't work anymore later on. I did something else for the fourth experiment that I describe in the book. But behind all of those, there is always one thing that is always there, and that is meditation. If you don't assume some kind of, if you don't start by trying to take some kind of control of your stream of thoughts, even if it is to extinguish that stream of thoughts, I think you would have either no experience or a very confusing experience. So some form of disciplining your stream of thoughts, I think, is fundamental, whatever else you try in addition to that. Maybe a prejudice, Andrew, I don't know.
No, that's I've seen both. You can actually go into there's meditation, they're forming control and doing that. And then there's actually where, you know, somebody just literally in the middle of the day just goes into that. That's, you can't control that. It's like somebody going in, you know, that daydream atmosphere or whatever. It's like the old guy nodding off in the middle of the afternoon. But, yeah, so I tend to agree with you. In order to actually do control, you have to this time I want to go to dreamscape or go that. You would have to, you know, go in some sort of meditative.
It didn't work always for me. Many more times than not, I made the decision and nothing happened. I got nowhere. So it was a long process. And to this day, it is very rare that I managed to get back there. I think what really worked for me is, after I got there for the first time in an unambiguous way, then you believe it. You believe that there is somewhere to get to. Then after you have that first experience and you know how real it feels and how amazing and inevitable it feels, then you realize that, hey, this is not just stories here. There is something very palpable, something very concrete to these states of mind that escape all explanation from the point of view of reductionist science. You cannot place it in any reductionist model, be it psychology, be it quantum physics, whatever you name. Once you've had that experience the first time and you know it's there, you give yourself permission to believe, and then it's much easier to get there again. That was my personal experience.
So what was the method you used?
Meditation was the mainstream behind all this, and I think there are as many meditation techniques as there are meditators. There are small things have worked for me at different times. For instance, that Tibetan technique of closing your eyelids and looking up. The choice of the moment when you do that, you feel in your body sometimes that I am receptive to this at this point in time, at this location. You feel that. And then you have to seize that moment, because most of the times I don't feel like I can get there at all. I do have a brain entrainment machine, a psychic Walkman, psycho Walkman, I think they call it. I do have it. It has proven useful in the beginning, although when the experience starts, you have to get rid of it, otherwise it just grounds you. I've tried many different things.
Because let me say this from my side, from going through dream, because this is why I look at, there's people understand what's going out of body in dreamscape, is like everybody goes out of body when they go in, this is how, I'm telling you from an esoteric way of looking at it. Everybody, when they go, it leaves their body, their mind, because your consciousness is always attached. It's almost like a propeller going out into the universe. And when you're out into that universe, it's like when you're, everybody has dreams. That's the dream part. That's unconsciously doing it. When you're consciously doing, going into dreams, that's actually going out of your body. And when you're going into there's called different levels, depending where you're at. And so the lower levels, you would actually visually see things like what you're talking about. As you go to further places, further in a higher state of consciousness, where you go to places of nothingness. So what they say is, this is how they say it, and you'll find out most esoterics will say, is you go to the reason why you go to a place of nothingness. You know, that's where they tell you go in consciously the place of nothingness, and then you come back down. And when you come back down, of what there is something, that something is actually the reality of your manifestation of what the reality of within your own soul is, you know, in the universe. It's not you're creating anything. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Before you're actually being the artist. Before, if you go to the nothingness, it's actually the universe showing you. You're actually just receiving from the information of the universe. This is like where an artist or ideas and all those things that come in. You're going to a place of nothingness, and then all of a sudden you go, "Oh wow, I have epiphany. I know what that is. Now I know that's that place." And you can do it in cycles. So what was interesting? I know we have to wrap up pretty soon. But what was fascinating, I'm just saying this is just my own read from your, especially your first reading, what the first experiment. The other ones, I have a gut feeling where it was going on. But the first one is actually, personally, I just feel that was attachment from a past life. Like you are actually going, the images that you're seeing, because I believe that in a lot of esoterics, you go from lifetime, you don't take your Mercedes and your cars with you, you take your experiences with you, and that's attached to your soul.
Mm-hmm.
When you come back around, those are always popped out. Like you'll find yourself, you go to a place, and like I was in the Middle East, and for some reason I knew areas like back of my hand. I know that if I went to, I was in other areas. Like I know if I go to the Far East, there's places in the Far East. I have seen them. I have done where people ask me to go find things. I had a person ask me to go find a dog. They're missing a dog. So I had a visually, I don't explain, but I project myself there. I've never been to that area. And she was blown away how I visually saw exactly everything that was there. So those are like crossing the lines that's like attached in. But in your thing, I really think that that was a past life thing, that you were in Tibet. And that's what the images that you were seeing.
Oh, those mandalas.
Totally. I think that was really, that's just my feeling, you know, but I may be wrong, but that's my, you know, if I was to say that's what I think those were. But let me ask you this in summation. If, you know, because at the end of your book, and you make a real good reference, let me pull it out. I've got my eyes here. But you made a really good point toward at the end of your book, in your closing thoughts, which is sort of funny, you say, we have come to the end of this journey, one with more questions than answers, more possibilities than solutions, more ideas than conclusions, yet it is my hope that it has been a valid journey, for before the one can focus one's gaze on a narrow set of possibilities about the nature of reality, one must first step back and look open-mindedly at all possibilities, especially those that contradict one's own perception, culture biases, and prejudices. This is basically what you've been saying all along, that we have to change our preconceived notions, even including our sciences.
Yeah, that's the core of what I'm trying to put across, that we've limited ourselves a lot in our search for closure, and we may be missing the big white elephant in the room, which is the cosmic mystery, a small subset of which is our ordinary daily experience.
So what would you say, how can we fit this? What would be... From not just from your experiences with the book, but you're sitting in front of everybody, a bunch of group of scientists, what would you tell them to change? Hey, quit. What would you ask them to change?
Well, if
because it doesn't seem it would come from a public. It looks like this book is more for scientists need to read this more than.
Well, I think I don't want to sound arrogant because who am I to know anything? But if I take some poetic license to answer your question the way you asked it, I would say, no, don't allow yourselves into the false belief that we figured it all out and that there is no mystery and that there is no purpose and there is no meaning, that this is all a mechanistic play of atoms and we have no choice in any of this and we are just waiting for the day when it will all end and the curtains will draw down. I think this is just a story we are telling ourselves. When we are born, when we are children, we see enchantment, mystery everywhere. A bird flying in front of our eyes is a profoundly enchanting thing. But culture kills it by giving it names, giving it words, giving partial explanations and making all kinds of assumptions about what is allowed to be and not to be. And I think we shouldn't lose our enchantment. We are living bang in the middle of an unfathomable cosmic mystery, and we just don't know what's going on. And that's incredibly cool in my mind.
I think, I'm trying to remember the saying, but George Carlin said something about that, how the tools of our language or something to that effect created the lies or something like that. I'm trying to remember the comment he made. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know the specific quote, but I think I get a taste from what you're saying. Language is the art of labeling things, so we pretend we know what we are talking about.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember his quote. I had it in front because I deleted it from somebody I was talking to about it, but it's basically talking about how here it is. I found it. It said that, this is George Carlin said, by and large, language is a tool for concealing the truth.
Oh, I buy completely into that. I'm going to read this.
Yeah, that's what he says. By and large, language is a tool for concealing the truth.
It is, of course, language is very helpful. I don't want also to say that there is no value for language. It's a very useful tool for survival, but we take it to extremes. We kill the mystery. We kill the enchantment. We can give very concrete examples of this. When we say cars move because of energy or objects fall because of gravity, wait a moment. What is energy? What is gravity? How do they do what they do? Does anybody know? Do you know? I certainly don't know what gravity really is. I don't know how it does what it does. I hear a story that it bends space-time. Wait a moment. What is space-time that it can bend?
But this is like, to reiterate from what I said in the beginning, it's like I took in my class. I took people in my class I was teaching. I told them, visually. I told them, bite into the apple. And while they're eating the apple, they're experiencing the apple. And while they're experiencing the apple, I said, well, don't think about what you're experiencing. Just experience, be it what they call the now, just experience it. And he says, tell me the wisdom of the apple. And they immediately try to explain it. He says, no, that's not the wisdom. Now you're explaining the understanding of it.
Yeah, you're making the map. You're making the model.
So that's the difference. So I'm saying the wisdom is before you try to apply words to it.
Absolutely. Wisdom is raw perception. It's the only reality we can ever know. Everything else is concepts.
Right, and that's when we try to place it into words, it becomes more limited. And the reason I was going to say to you, somebody had, and it was actually somebody who was an esoteric, made a comment. The reason I was trying to get with the clicks per second, all that, is our frequency. Like our energy is basically, this I explained to you, numerology and stuff like that. We're basic energy, we're vibrating our frequency. And the higher frequency we have, the higher, which is what people consider enlightened or whatever, as you get toward enlightened, you actually perceive things, even with your own eyes, your own ears, you start perceiving the realities of the universe more and more and more. So you're actually able to see more. This is actually a fact. I mean, if you increase yourself, your frequency, you're going to be able to see more things than other people. This is where people like, you know, the Einsteins and people like that were actually have more clicks per second. They're increasing their frequency. They see things, the reality of more things that are events are happening. So they're able to see those. When they apply those words, that's a whole different story. But they're actually able to visually experience more things because their frequency is higher. Therefore, they're able to understand the information because they're always getting information consistently coming to us. It's just based upon our frequency understanding that. And what's really weird is, what string physics is happening is actually coming in unison to a lot of the esoterics. A lot of the stuff that's sort of ironically what you hear, you hear what quantum physics talks about and what they go into string physics and all the physics, it's sort of funny, is actually the more they're like slowly going the little steps and steps moving forward on that, it's ironically identical to what all the Kabbalists and all the Taoists have been saying for thousands and thousands of years, and all the shamans. It's like almost like science is catching up to the esoterics.
That is striking, isn't it?
And that's where, and the only thing I'm afraid of is, which I'm happy that's heading toward that, I don't want to see where, like what you said in the very beginning, because we have to shut this stuff out, but is where people want to be one and the same, and if they do that, they're going to lose the the beautiful nature of science having its own objectivity, because they need to be sort of separated, but they have to have like a crosshair of unison and different elements. And when we have that crosshair, then it'll be fine. So yeah. Got to wrap up now, and I want to thank you for coming on my show. But I want to ask you, just tell my audience how they can contact or check out your book or anything else.
All right. The book's called Dreamed Up Reality. It's my second book out of three. Information about the book and about me and some articles that I regularly write online can be found on my website. That is www.bernardokestrup.com. That is Bernardo, Bernardo, Kestrup, Kastrup, one word, BernardoKestrup.com.
Well, Dr. Kestrup, I want to thank you for coming on my show. It was highly enlightening. I highly recommend everybody to get his book, Dreamed Up Reality, especially you scientists out there. I think we need to move into another direction within our sciences. It is absolutely necessary for humanity, and it's taking politics aside and religious norms out of the picture. And if we were to do that, we would actually advance ourselves tenfold over. But again, I want to thank you for coming on our show. It was highly, highly enlightening, and I'm very happy to have you on. Thanks
for inviting me. I appreciated the conversation a lot. This was far more than an interview. I had a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you very much. And I wish all the out there, I want to thank you all for listening. God bless you all. And all those who are out there occupied, please, no violence. Do it with love. We're all one people, one humanity, and one universe. God bless you all, and have a glorious, glorious weekend. Thank you.